A Wisconsin politician's aide once typed five words into an email that would accidentally reveal America's darkest secret: no one cares about crazy people. She was dismissing concerns about mental health funding, but her brutal honesty exposed something most of us would rather ignore. We've built a society that warehouses the mentally ill in prisons, shuffles them onto streets, and looks away when they suffer. But what happens when mental illness doesn't strike a stranger, when it shatters your own family? Ron Powers never wanted to write about his son's descent into schizophrenia. As a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, he'd spent a decade protecting their story, guarding his grief like a secret wound. Then his younger son, Kevin, hanged himself at 21, and his older son, Dean, began showing similar symptoms. Powers broke his silence not just to mourn, but to ask an uncomfortable question. If we don't care about crazy people, what happens when the person suffering is someone we love? Sanity is a thin membrane, barely visible, easily torn. Mental illness has no visible markers. You can't see schizophrenia on an X-ray. You only witness its effects, the person you knew disappearing behind eyes that no longer recognize you. Powers' sons were brilliant before their membranes tore. Dean wrote poetry capturing forgotten worlds. Kevin discovered his calling at 5, becoming a virtuosic musician whose fingers translated emotion into melody. They thrived until genetics, stress, and adolescent brain development ripped open their protective membranes. Powers transforms private agony into universal truth. By refusing to hide behind shame, he forces us to see that mentally ill people aren't dangerous strangers. They're our children, siblings, neighbors. They're people we love, watching helplessly as their minds betray them. The word bedlam originated from London's Priory of St. Mary of Bethlehem, accepting lunatics around 1403. For 4 centuries, it defined Western mental health care: chains, beatings, ice water torture, spinning chairs. Uneducated keepers raped female patients. Visitors paid admission to watch the mad perform like zoo animals. 2 revolutionaries imagined something different. Philippe Pinel removed chains from 49 inmates at Bicêtre Hospital. William Tuke established York Retreat, a hilltop home offering compassion instead of punishment. This moral treatment movement reached America, where Dr. Benjamin Rush rejected demonic theories and Dr. Samuel Woodward implemented the law of kindness. The most remarkable reformer was Dorothea Dix, who in 1841 discovered half-naked lunatics caged with criminals. She traveled 30,000 miles documenting conditions and directly established 32 asylums by 1880. But moral treatment couldn't survive America's population explosion. Asylums buckled under overcrowding, deteriorating from therapeutic communities into custodial warehouses, some grotesquely repurposed as commercial haunted attractions, trivializing real suffering. While moral treatment represented humanity's highest aspirations, another movement emerged targeting the mentally ill for extinction. Charles Darwin's theories were twisted into eugenics, the pseudoscientific belief that humanity could be improved by preventing the unfit from reproducing. Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin, published Hereditary Genius in 1869, claiming intelligence was fixed by bloodlines. His proposals evolved from arranging marriages to advocating stern compulsion to prevent reproduction among those with mental illness. The list of eugenic supporters reads like a who's who of American heroes. Theodore Roosevelt embraced it to prevent degenerates from reproducing. Madison Grant, who saved redwoods and founded the Bronx Zoo, became eugenics' American champion. His 1916 book, The Passing of the Great Race, advocated eliminating social discards, beginning with the criminal, the diseased, and the insane. Hitler called it my Bible. America didn't just inspire Nazi eugenics, we practiced it enthusiastically. Indiana enacted the first compulsory sterilization law in 1909. California sterilized 20,000 mental patients by 1979. The Supreme Court sanctioned this horror in Buck v. Bell, with Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. declaring, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough." The case was built on lies. Carrie Buck was a rape victim, not feeble-minded, and her daughter made the honor roll. By 1941, Nazi Germany had murdered nearly 100,000 psychiatric patients, following America's lead. Despite 30,000 research articles published between 1998 and 2007, schizophrenia remains poorly understood. It's not one disease, but a rare clustering of distinct brain malfunctions, genetic in nature, but requiring environmental triggers like stress during gestation or adolescence. The prefrontal cortex doesn't fully mature until after age 20, when synaptic pruning occurs, the necessary loss of gray matter to reorganize cortical connections. Schizophrenia-inducing gene clusters often activate during this pruning, with researchers identifying 128 gene variants connected to the disease. Schizophrenia has a strange relationship with genius. Researchers introduced schizotypy, personality traits existing on a spectrum from normal dissociative states to psychosis, manifesting as either mental illness or enhanced creativity. Powers saw this in his sons. Kevin's virtuosic musical abilities, even when psychotic, Dean's storytelling gifts that transformed mundane reality into fabulous realms. When antipsychotic medication arrived in 1954, Cold War America embraced sanity in a bottle. French chemist Paul Charpentier synthesized chlorpromazine in 1950, producing indifference to surroundings. By 1955, the FDA approved it as Thorazine, marking the threshold of technological solutions to mental disorders. These medications genuinely help millions by restoring cognition and suspending hallucinations, but they don't cure. They temporarily repress symptoms that return when medication stops. The 1960s dismantled America's mental health system through three devastating waves. Thomas Sowes declared mental illness merely metaphor, wonder medications promised to make traditional psychiatry obsolete, and politically driven deinstitutionalization released hundreds of thousands with only prescriptions and inadequate support. On Halloween 1963, President Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Act, his last bill before assassination, aiming to move 560,000 patients from overcrowded state institutions into 1,500 community centers. Vietnam War costs froze construction at fewer than 650 centers, yet asylum populations plummeted to 130,000 by 1980. The 1965 Medicaid legislation prohibited federal reimbursement for psychiatric patients in state hospitals, so states simply released patients into the community, which meant the streets. In 1967, Governor Reagan signed legislation barricading California hospital doors against admitting resistant patients until judicial hearings, devastating those with anosognosia, the inability to recognize one's own illness. By 2015, over 350,000 mentally ill inmates languished in U.S. prisons, 10 times those in psychiatric hospitals, with 83% receiving no treatment. Housing prisoners costs $10,000 to $100,000 annually, while states cut $1.8 billion from mental health services between 2009 and 2011. Kevin's first crisis at 17 wasn't substance abuse, it was hallucinations. After intensive therapy, he planned to attend Berklee College of Music, but following a successful performance, his mental state collapsed. The 4 a.m. call came, Kevin claiming he'd been selected to tour Russia. By morning, reality emerged. He'd boarded a Greyhound to Los Angeles, believing he would work as a rock star. Removed for disoriented behavior, he was hospitalized. Doctors initially diagnosed bipolar disorder, a less frightening label the family accepted. But at Thanksgiving, Dean found Kevin asking if he could see the large blue three-dimensional musical note suspended between them. When finally diagnosed with schizophrenia, Kevin initially accepted treatment. One bright moment came when nurses allowed Kevin his guitar. The brothers gave an impromptu concert, trading rhythm and melody in sublime communion. During a family wedding trip, Kevin announced he was stopping his medications. His anosognosia was complete. His final months alternated between hopeful clarity and relapse, playing in jazz combos, performing at Vermont bars, finishing his jazz suite Primo Shadino. On July 15, 2005, Ron discovered Kevin in the basement. His son had hanged himself. Mental health care advances along contradictory paths, rapid scientific progress, and sluggish social reform. America's mentally ill are still warehoused in prisons. Suicides claim 38,000 Americans yearly, with mentally ill people dying 23 years earlier than average. Yet progress exists. Advocates like Pete Early have become powerful voices. Legislation like the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act represents historic federal action, and organizations like Clubhouse International offer companionship without therapy. Powers ends with cautious hope about Dean, now 35 and doing well in a small house his parents found. Here's the truth that politicians' aide got wrong. Someone does care about crazy people. Parents care, siblings care, friends care. And when we admit that the membrane separating sanity from madness is thinner than we'd like to believe, maybe we'll all start caring enough to build a system worthy of our shared humanity.